He spoke more quietly. An old guy who claimed to be the mayor tried to make a speech about not signing. We shot him and hung his body from a tree. We said if anybody moved him before we came back in 5 days, we'd shoot some more. Sarah clapped her hands.
I never would have thought of that. Brilliant. I'll bet they were utterly terrified.
It's hard to tell. They were all sort of stony-faced.
Well, watching the mayor rot for a few days should soften them up.
She turned to the men that had been with Russell. She said in Spanish, You can all go along now, gentlemen. Mr. Ruiz will pay you while I talk with Mr. Russell. Mr. Ruiz, the money is in the black briefcase on the desk. She and Russell walked toward her car, a black Maybach which was parked a distance away.
Without you, my efforts and a considerable sum of money would have been wasted. I'm acutely aware of the hardships you've endured because of your work. You'll be paid very well for everything. The trust you've earned will pay dividends.
I hope the risk pays off for you.
It's essential that we succeed. These Indian peasants are sitting on a major Mayan site, and we'll need a free hand to exploit it. They have to be removed quickly, before the word gets out and they become a cause.
What I'm worried about is what happens after we've brought them here. Will San Martin let you keep what you find? His mercenaries make him stronger than we are.
Trust me, she said. Diego needs me more than I need him. Being on land that belongs to me keeps him untouchable. And as long as you give me your loyalty, I promise you will be safe.
She stopped walking. My driver is new, and I don't know if I can trust him yet.
If you have anything else to say, say it now.
In that moment of her immobility, frozen for 2 seconds, Russell saw many things. Her beauty, which was something she possessed, just like her cars and land and bank accounts. And he knew that this chance to speak and change things was one he would never have after this moment. If he wanted out, the doorway was closing. When the 2 seconds had passed without his speaking, she turned and walked to the black car. She opened the door herself, sat in the back seat, and closed the door. Her face, even her silhouette, became invisible behind the tinted glass. The driver swung her car wide and brought it back along the gravel drive to the main road. Santa Maria de los Montañes. The whole town attended the funeral of the mayor, partly because of his heroic death. And Carlos Padilla had been a popular mayor because he did little except to fill out and sign the papers that had to be filed in Guatemala City each year. He was such a comfortable mayor, in fact, that there was some question as to whether he was still legally in office. There had not been an election in some years, and it was possible that he had not wanted to bother anyone with voting again. Father Gomez said the proper things about him during the Mass and then led the villagers to the large churchyard, where their people had been buried for centuries, and placed him in the row created for this year's dead. There, Father Gomez said the rest of the customary pronouncements, and prayed that Carlos's goodness, bravery, and unselfishness would make his soul quickly rise to heaven. While old Andreas, the mayor's brother, took his turn filling the grave, Father Gomez asked the townspeople to return to the church for a meeting. When the people were all sitting in the church or standing immediately outside where they could hear, he introduced Dr. Huerta. Dr. Huerta spoke simply and frankly.
We have spoken to the authorities in the government offices and embassies, and the earliest that help can come here is 30 days.
But we have only 5 days, a woman shouted. What can we do?
You can sign the paper and be taken to the estancia to work in the fields. Or you can stay and fight. The choice is yours. But we saw those men shoot Carlos to death. I don't know of any reason to trust them. Once they have you on the estancia, with no place to hide and no means of fighting back, will they let you live? There were cries of, we have to fight, and we have no choice. There's a third way, said Father Gomez. We can pack everyone up and run away to another town. We can try to hold out there for a month or two and hope the government will act by then. All they will do is get two towns killed, said Pepe. And once we leave, they'll take over everything, dig up the tombs, burn our houses and fields. We'll never be able to come back. Within minutes, the discussion was only a series of speakers who all said the same thing. Running was futile and was more dangerous than staying. Signing away the town was unthinkable, and the only way to survive was to fight. At last, Dr. Huerta said, "It's time to hear from Sam and Remy Fargo." Sam and Remy had remained silent through the discussion, but now they stood. Sam said, "If you want to fight, we'll do what we can to help. Tomorrow morning at 7, meet us in front of the church. If you have any guns and ammunition, bring them with you. We'll begin to work out a strategy." At 7 a.m., Sam and Remy sat on the church steps and waited. The first to arrive were a few of the hotheads who had helped capture Sam and Remy up on the plateau. Then came people who considered themselves to be part of the gentry, the business owners, independent farmers, and their wives, sons, and daughters. After them were others, people who worked for wages or helped on the farms for a share of the crops. By 7:30, the street was full of more people than it had been during the mercenaries' roundup. Sam stood up and called the group to order. "Beginning with the people on this end of the street, form a line and come talk with us. After you have, then go wait in the church." As people came to the steps to talk, Sam and Remy would interview them, always speaking Spanish now. "Do you have a gun? Let me look it over. Are you a hunter? What do you hunt? Are you a good shot?" When there was no gun, they would ask, "Are you healthy? Can you run a mile without stopping? Do you want to fight? If you needed a weapon to fight a jaguar, what would you reach for?" Women seemed to prefer to talk to Remy, possibly out of local standards of propriety. Her questions varied little. "How old are you? Are you married? Do you have any children? Are you willing to fight to protect them? Are you very strong and healthy? Have you ever fired a gun?" The older children, the teenagers, were the hardest to interview, but Sam and Remy persisted. All the armies of the past had relied on boys from 15 to 20 to fill the ranks. By 10, they were alone on the steps. The town's firepower amounted to 7 rifles with about 100 rounds each, 8 shotguns with about 1 box of 25 shells each, mostly birdshot. There were 7 handguns, including 4 38 K-frame revolvers that looked like old police sidearms, Senora Velasquez's old 38 Colt, and 2 32 caliber pistols made for concealed carry. Sam and Remy stood, staring at the villagers, whose faces were tinged with hopelessness. "Thank you all," said Sam. "Now we have a better idea of where to start. Your ancestors could not fight soldiers trained in modern tactics or go up against new technical weapons, and neither can you. You, your wives and children, would die within minutes of the first attack." Remy could easily see a deep sadness in the villagers' eyes, as mothers pulled their children closer and the men looked around at their friends and neighbors in frustration. Sam steeled himself against the impossible odds. He nodded at Dr. Huerta and Father Gomez. "Can I talk to you in the vestry?" They entered and sat down in the hand-carved chairs around the large Spanish-style table. Father Gomez spoke directly to Sam.
"Do you have a strategy?" he asked.
Sam shook his head. "Nothing I can guarantee."
"You have no plan, no strategy to help save my people," said Father Gomez coldly.
"Nothing I can talk about," asserted Sam.
"What do you want us to do?" Dr. Huerta demanded.
"Take your people up the mountain to the fortress and tombs."
Father Gomez glared at Sam.
I believe the villagers would just as soon die in their beds as be dragged down the hill to trucks that will carry them to the Estancia fields, where they would work themselves to death. And then there are the children. It will be like a concentration camp.
Remy, who had been standing in the doorway unnoticed, stared at Sam with stunned incomprehension.
You don't know what you're saying. Sending the villagers up to the old fortress is like giving them a one-way ticket to a slow death.
The trucks can't navigate the narrow trail up the mountain, said Sam.
But 100 men with deadly arms can't be stopped with a few old shotguns, Remy argued.
Sam shrugged. I see no other way out.
Remy stepped over to Sam and stared with anguish into his eyes.
Who are you? She gasped. You're not the man I've known and loved.
He gave her a look of indifference she'd never seen before. As Remy turned to speak, Sam had walked from the vestry without looking back at his lovely wife.
Chapter 30 Santa Maria de los Montañas. The next day, the mothers, children, and the elderly were led by Remy to the ruined stronghold on the plateau. There they would gather hundreds of stones to throw down at the attackers if they tried to climb the narrow path up. Remy determined where the best locations were behind a rock-stack barrier to fire at any attacker who reached the top. Remy kept her mind off Sam's strange behavior and directed her squad of women and children to make effigies of townspeople, stuffing clothing with leaves and brush. If your son is firing a rifle, you want the enemy to waste ammunition shooting at the 5 or 6 dummies you made and placed around to protect him. She had other people bringing empty bottles, cans of gasoline, and rags to the plateau and making Molotov cocktails. If men are coming up the path, these will stop them for a time. And if it's night, they'll light them up so anyone with a gun can hit them. At dusk, Sam stood on the crest of the hill beside the ancient fortress, surveying the preparations the townspeople had made. He knew there were hundreds of human effigies, beginning on the trail to the ancient stronghold. There were pits from building the old rock barrier. Within the walls of the ancient fortress were enough food and water for the whole town for a couple of weeks, and there were shelters for the children. The whole perimeter had dummies at the ramparts, and the supply of rocks and Molotov cocktails was impressive. Sam was suddenly aware that Remy was standing next to him. I can't live without you, she said softly. Please don't stay in the village and die there alone.
Sam shook his head and looked down. I've never asked you to blindly follow my direction. I have to ask you now. Trust me. She turned to him and looked for something in his eyes.
We've never had any secrets between us.
I'm sorry, Remy, but I swore an oath many years ago that I have to stand by. And now I have to see this through.
I know you have something up your sleeve. But will it work?
He ran his hand through her hair. The final throw of the dice. And I can't even tell you what I hope is going to happen.
Sam looked up at the last of the sun-painted mountain peaks. It's time for me to go.
Sam put his arm about his beloved wife and escorted her to the head of the trail that led down the mountain. She buried her face in his shoulder.
You just can't do this. I may never see you again.
His kiss was as gentle as a soft whisper. I've made luncheon reservations at our favorite restaurant here in town. After walking 20 feet through the fortress, Remy stopped to get a final look at her husband. But Sam was not to be seen. It was as if he had vanished.
Santa Maria de los Montañas.
At dawn, Sam walked across the road to the church and climbed the ladder to the top of the bell tower. His timing was on the money. He removed a pair of German Steiner 20x80 military binoculars and peered through the lenses at a dust cloud on the road about 5 miles away. Almost casually, he sat on a niche in the wall and watched the sunrise. Later, he stared at the approaching military convoy. Sam was not primed to fight. His job was to observe. He took a small, old-fashioned, handheld radio he'd borrowed from Dr. Huerta, adjusted the frequency, and pressed the call button. Viper One, this is Cobra One, over. A voice, clear and sharp, came back almost immediately.
Cobra One, this is Viper One. I haven't heard your voice in a long time. Over.
6 years and 7 months, to be exact.
We've all missed you, Cobra One.
Is that Viper Two?
200 meters on your left in an open space in the forest.
You have been away a long time, laughed Viper Two. I remember you as the new kid on the block in the old days.
You must know, said Viper One. The firm is stepping on important toes to fit this little tea party in the schedule.
I'm well aware of it, replied Sam.
And, I might add, I'm the only one on this side who knows the score.
Okay, said Viper One. Why don't you tell us the score? Over.
Roger, said Sam.
A small army of men who work for a local drug lord are planning to come here to take possession of the town and ship the people to a plantation about 20 miles away and put them to work.
That sounds like slavery.
It is slavery, said Sam.
And extortion, and theft, and kidnapping, and murder. Once they have these people in their marijuana fields, nobody will ever see or hear from them again. Over.
Nice to know where the good guys, Viper Two cut in. Hold on. I read a convoy of 7 vehicles approaching up the road.
Sam added what he could see from his perch in the bell tower.
Each of the canvas-covered trucks is carrying 25 men, all armed with AK-47s. They're escorted by 2 armored cars, one at the head of the column, the other bringing up the rear.
We also see the convoy is escorted by 2 Mi-8 Russian-built gunships.
How can you know everything in my sight when you're behind a forested mountain?
We've had many upgrades in our sensors since you were part of the gang.
Sam aimed his binoculars at the final turn in the road leading up to the village.
Viper One, they've reached the edge of the town and have stopped.
Not surprised. There are no people in sight, living or dead. That must make them wonder.
My wife and I herded all the villagers up the mountain to an ancient fortress.
The pilots and gunners in the Apaches adjusted their helmets with the monocle over the right eye. It was a revolutionary sighting system. The pilot or gunner could slave the chain gun to his helmet, allowing him to achieve accurate sighting on a target by making the chain gun track with his head movements, aiming wherever he looked.
Viper Two, this is Viper One. We are clear to engage. Time to give them hell for breakfast.
Viper One turned the Apache in a sharp bank and then entered the main village square, hovering 20 meters off the cobblestones.
Chapter 31. Santa Maria de los Montañas.
Amando Gervais and his co-pilot and gunner, Rico Sabas, sat side by side in the spacious cockpit of their Mi-8 hip gunship, one of San Martin's fleet of 5 helicopters. The Mi-8 was Russian-built and was an oldie but goodie. Production had continued despite the 51 years since the first one took to the skies. Utilized by half the military forces in the world, the Mi-8 was considered the most successful design worldwide. Gervais lightly touched the collective control stick to raise the Mi-8 until it was 5 meters off the ground. At the same time, he eased the cyclic stick forward, slowly moving the Mi-8 up the rise and around the church and into the village square. Suddenly, Gervais and Sabas froze, in a state of shock. Instead of a crowd of villagers with pitchforks and shotguns firing birdshot, Gervais and Sabas found themselves staring at an array of rocket launchers hung on the most malevolent, atrocious, and evil attack helicopter in the United States arsenal.
To Sam Fargo in the bell tower, there was no more terrifying apparition than the AH-64E Apache Longbow helicopter, especially when viewed head-on. It looked like a giant, grotesque bug that could never fly.
"Santa Maria,"
muttered Sabas.
"Where did that come from?"
"It's black, with no markings,"
said Hervais, barely above a whisper.
"What's he doing here?"
The answer never came. They turned white and speechless when, in the blink of an eye, they saw a flash beneath the Apache an instant before they were blown to shreds.
"Target removed, Viper 2."
"So I heard.
Hold on. My target is locked and I'm firing."
Down the hill a few miles away, another explosion sent fire and a dense cloud of smoke into the air.
"Viper 1, second aerial target eliminated."
So much for their air force, Viper 2. Now let's hit their infantry.
"Cobra 1 here," Sam Fargo cut in. "The trucks and armored cars are continuing toward the village."
"How can they think they still have air cover?"
"They didn't see your destructive nature. You were out of sight in the village, and Viper 2 was hidden in the trees."
"Thanks, Cobra," said Viper 1's pilot. "Keep active as our spotter."
"Will do," said Sam. "Glad to be back in the saddle again."
"Okay, Viper 2. We'll start from opposite ends with the armored cars and work toward the middle of the trucks.
Engage before they recover. What do you want to lay on them?"
"Begin with the Hydra missiles to knock out the armored cars, and then switch to the M230 cannon against the trucks and infantry.
Viper 2, you take on the front armored car. I'll engage tail end Charlie."
"Just watch our line of fire so we don't kill each other."
"Roger, Viper 2. We'll be as careful as ladies at a tea."
"Roger that, Viper 1.
With a touch of a button, he sent a Hydra missile across the village square into the armored car as it reached the top of the hill. Flames enveloped the disintegrating vehicle as it vanished in a vast fireball. Sam laughed to himself.
"I'll ring the church bell every time you guys take out a truck."
"I've never forgotten your sense of humor."
"Nothing's changed," said Sam.
"Ready to squeeze the pumpkin, Viper 1?
"Let's ride the dragon," came the answer.
The Apaches showed their stuff by flying barrel rolls over the hill and turning loops through the village, passing a few feet from Sam's observation post.
"Where are our Mi-8 copters?" asked Russell. He pulled himself back inside the armored car.
"I don't like the looks of this.
There's no sign of them. Only two plumes of black smoke."
"Could they have collided?"
Russell shook his head.
"They came at the village from opposite directions.
The smoke must be from targets they destroyed in the village."
"Then why don't they answer our transmissions?"
"That I don't..." Before Russell could finish, the vicious AH-64E Longbow helicopter appeared 30 meters above, the pilot smiling and waving. The Longbow suddenly rolled upward and turned to a firing position. It not only looked deadly, it was deadly.
"Get out!" shouted Russell. "Jump!"
Ruiz didn't have to be told twice. They burst from the armored car, leaving the gun crew inside. They dropped to the ground and rolled into a ditch on the side of the road. Less than 3 seconds later, Russell heard the short scream of the Hydra 70 rocket as it impacted the armored car and blew its turret to pieces. In the black killing machine, the gunner had turned the muzzle of the M230 automatic cannon, mounted under the bow of the fuselage, toward the first truck in the convoy. Called a chain gun, it could spurt 650 30-millimeter rounds a minute. The blast of shells tore through the first and second truck's canvas-covered benches, carrying the 25 armed killers hired by San Martin that quickly became fiery charnel houses. There was no time for a warning. The third truck drove off the road, spilling out the men as soon as it rolled into the ditch. One man on the fourth truck threw back the canvas cover and began to shoot a mounted gun at the Apache.
"I'm taking fire, Viper 2. I could use help to take him out."
"I'll send him to Dreamland.
Just stay on your side of the convoy."
Viper One could hear shells thumping into the rotor blades and fuselage, which was protected by 2,600 pounds of shielding. Viper Two dipped under Viper One and unleashed a torrent of fire that smashed the man in the truck bed and his heavy machine gun to a pile of morbid junk.
"Obliged to you, Viper Two. You still in one piece?
Roger. Engaging Truck Five on my goal line.
Let's finish the game."
The flames from one truck and the explosion and concussion from another were still tearing the air when the last truck tried to escape across the field. It was quickly smashed to a halt. The survivors spilled to the ground, followed by a hail of shells pouring from the Apache like water from a fireman's hose. Both Apaches obliterated the rest of the convoy and circled the area, picking off any survivors who did not throw down their weapons or hold their hands up in surrender.
As Russell and Ruiz watched from the cover of the ditch along the side of the road, the heat from their flaming armored car was like torture to them. They lay there, staring in fascinated horror at the total destruction of the convoy by the phantom black helicopters.
"It makes no sense," Russell muttered. "Who are they, and where did they come from?"
"They are not Guatemalan military," said Ruiz.
"Let's not wait to find out,"
Russell grunted, crawling away from the burning vehicle toward the nearest forest undergrowth.
"We have to find a place to lay low till it's dark."
"Sound thinking, my friend," Russell said. "Follow me and keep low."
"Where to?"
"Estancia Guerrero," answered Russell. "We've got to get to Miss Allersby with a story to save our hides before another survivor makes it back."
Remy's heart sank when she heard the explosions and saw the black billowing clouds expanding in the sky above the village. She was helping the mothers with young children, distracting them from the turbulence below. The silence that followed was even worse. The fear and anxiety finally got the best of her, and she ran desperately out of the fortress and down the trail until she reached the village square. She stood there dazed after seeing the smoldering wreckage of a helicopter. Remy saw no sign of Sam and closed her eyes to keep from crying in grief. She could not but think the worst. She sensed a presence behind her, then Sam's voice. "How could our love affair not have a happy ending?" Remy turned, her eyes flashing in excitement as they locked with Sam's, and he kissed her lovingly on the lips. With his arms wrapped about her, Remy's fear melted.
"Oh, Sam,"
she murmured in his ear as she looked over his shoulder at what was left of the MI-8. At that moment, Viper One, followed by Viper Two, hovered over the square and gently touched down. The engines hummed, and the four-bladed main rotors slowed and crept to a stop. Sam grinned as four men in flight suits climbed out of the cockpits and approached. The first reached out his hand and shook Sam's.
"I've missed you, old partner."
"I'm amazed an old geezer like you is still flying the globe and getting into trouble."
The pilot from Viper Two laughed.
"We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for your talent for wheeling and dealing."
Remy stood by as the five men hugged one another and started telling war stories and catching up on old times. Remy thought it odd that none of them called one another by name. Finally, she looked at Sam and interrupted,
"Aren't you going to introduce me?"
They all looked at one another, surprised, and then broke into laughter. Sam took a confused Remy in his arms and said, "This is a very, very unusual group. It's on call around the world for operations such as the Estancia Guerrero. It's also the finest and least known secret operations force in the U.S.
"That's why our names and backgrounds are known only to ourselves," said the pilot of Viper Two.
"And we all swear an oath of secrecy when we join the force." The gunner of Viper One looked at Remy and said,
"So is this beautiful woman the reason you left the force?"
Sam smiled with a twinkle in his eye.
"That goes without saying."
He gave her an affectionate squeeze around the waist. Sorry, I can't give you her name. The villagers were cautiously returning to the village. They had an expression of disbelief at seeing the Apache longbows, the wreckage of the MI-8 hip, and their village completely intact. Father Gomez and Dr. Huerta stood in awe. Viper 2's gunner nodded at the growing crowd and said, "I think it's time for us to fold our tents and silently steal off into the sunset." "Thank you," said Sam as he shook their hands. "You saved the lives of over 200 men, women, and children, and shut down one of Central America's biggest drug operations."
"Don't wait so long for the next tournament," said Viper 1 with a salute.
"Don't change your phone number," Sam said, holding Remy's hand and giving her a kiss on the cheek. She looked squarely into his eyes and said, "You told me you were with the CIA when we met." Sam merely shrugged. "It seemed like a good idea at the time."
Chapter 32. The Road to the Estancia Guerrero. Ruiz sat in the cab of a truck beside Russell.
"I feel like I fell out of an airplane," he said. "My shoulder hurts from firing full auto at nothing. My knee feels like it's broken from falling in that ditch. I can't believe this."
Russell kept his eyes on the road ahead. "Consider yourself lucky we snatched a pickup truck from a tobacco farmer. This is really a setback. And we lost 90 men or more who belonged to Diego San Martin. I'll tell you something else. We've got to fix it before San Martin knows or get out of the country fast."
Ruiz stared at him.
"We're done, man. It's suicide to go in that town."
A half hour later, they reached the Estancia Guerrero. As they pulled up the long gravel drive to the space by the counting house, Russell saw Sarah Allersby sitting behind a lighted window. She saw their truck and ran out to meet them.
"Where are they?" she asked. "The helicopters never returned, nor any of the trucks."
Russell looked down at her through his cab window. "As it turned out, we couldn't just drive up there and load them on the trucks. When we got there, we were ambushed. We lost most of the men, and what few survived were captured."
"Lost? You lost 100 men to a bunch of ignorant peasants," she said. "How could you do this to me?"
Russell and Ruiz looked at each other and climbed stiffly out of the truck. Ruiz leaned against it while Russell stood in front of Sarah Allersby.
"Miss Allersby, I apologize. We were defeated, not by the villagers, but by two mysterious black, unmarked helicopters that blew apart our helicopters, the armored cars, and all the trucks."
Sarah Allersby felt the heat of Russell's rage building. It frightened her a little. She was too intelligent not to foresee what could happen next. Russell said,
"I think we've come to the end of our usefulness here.
We'll be leaving in a few minutes. I wish you luck."
He turned away.
"Wait," she said. "I'm sorry, Russell. I didn't mean to be sharp with you. Please don't be upset. I know I was being insensitive, and I know things seem bad right now, but we can save this."
Russell and Ruiz stared at her.
She said, "Those are men we borrowed from Diego San Martin. If you both leave, and that's all I have to tell him, he'll kill me. And then he'll have people find you and kill you. Don't you know he's a drug smuggler? He has connections and buyers in the United States and Europe. We don't have much choice but to salvage this situation so we can give him some good news along with the bad. We can't give up now."
"We can't save a disaster."
"I'll double your pay. I'll also give you a percentage of the money I make on the artifacts from that place. The Codex makes it look like a fortress and says that refugees from a city retreated there for a last stand. If they did that, they wouldn't have left their treasures behind to their enemies. It's going to be a huge find.
Miss Allersby, said Russell, people died today. If the police are brought in, anybody involved could be charged with murder. Not only were we the leaders, but we're foreigners.
We also don't know where our attackers came from, added Ruiz.
Chapter 33. The Road to Guatemala City. 2 days later, Russell and Ruiz were apprehended and shackled to the bench seat of the army truck as it rattled along the road toward Guatemala City. Russell kept up a low monologue in Ruiz's right ear.
It's good that they're taking us right to the capital. I don't want to rot in some provincial jail for 6 months while the prosecutors take their time getting there and arranging for a trial. If we're in Guatemala City, Sarah can bail us out before we've spent a night. Or 2 nights, anyway. And then she'll make the charges go away. That's what has to happen now. If we go to trial as the masterminds of this fiasco she dreamed up, we're going to need a miracle to see the light of day again.
Diego San Martin is hiding out. That's a plus.
True. But he isn't about to let us off the hook. They resent us. And we're the only Americans. I am, anyway. You look like a native and you speak Spanish. I'll bet they think you are Guatemalan.
If you're up for huge crimes, it's better to be foreign. They'll think you must be working for a government and they might not execute you.
She just better have all the lawyers out waiting for us when we get there, said Russell. She swore she would.
She said we'd never get arrested, too, but here we are, captured and chained.
Russell was silent for a few seconds, then said, "She'd better come through, after we manage to get his private army wiped out."
I know, said Ruiz. We're going to have to take turns sleeping, so none of these guys finds a way to kill us.
They sat in the truck and watched the miles rolling behind the truck into the distance. Russell tried to dismiss from his mind the sight of the few survivors sitting around him in the truck, the hollow look of their dirty, unshaven faces, the sweaty smell of their camouflage battle dress uniforms, the anger and resentment in their eyes. He turned his mind to Sarah Allersby. He imagined her in one of those immaculate white silk blouses she wore, and a black skirt and high heels. She would be standing by the heavy wooden desk in the 200-year-old building with the thick wooden beams and the big ceiling fans. She would have her golden hair in a tight ponytail, with every strand in place, so it looked like something rarer than hair. She would be holding one diamond earring in her free hand while she clamped the phone to her ear with the other. She would be bringing every bit of her wealth, influence and reputation to bear on the problem of freeing him and Ruiz. She would say something ridiculous that the government official she was speaking to would want to believe. Russell and Ruiz were just innocent American employees of hers who had gone to the Estancia Guerrero and gotten lost. She would ensure that there were no unpleasant repercussions following their release by flying them out of the country immediately in her private jet. And she would be very grateful to send them away. Guatemala City. At that moment, Sarah Allersby was in the master bedroom of the big Guerrero house. She was wearing a white silk blouse, a pair of black slacks, and a tailored black jacket. She chose a pair of pearl earrings and a pearl choker because she'd be dealing with British customs. Anyone whose job it was to assess the value of jewelry at a glance would recognize a strand like this. Round, silvery white, 16-millimeter natural pearls with exceptional luster. They had been found by divers in the Arabian Sea in the 14th century. And for once, the source of a priceless piece wasn't the fruit of her father's ancestors' looting of India. The pearls had belonged to her mother's family. Her father had bought the earrings in Paris 40 years ago. British officials were the biggest snobs. Even if her name didn't spring to their minds,
They would recognize her as belonging to the class of people who were not to be harassed with petty rules. She didn't pack much this trip. Most of her clothes and belongings were still in the closets and the safe. She took only the few things she could gather quickly. The wide, flat jewelry box with the best pieces, a bundle of money in various currencies, and sealed in its fitted plastic box, the Mayan Codex. They all fit in one suitcase. She locked the suitcase, tipped it up on its wheels, and began to roll it toward the staircase. Her doorman heard the sound, bounded up the stairs, and took it for her. She wondered, did he know? The case held tens of millions of dollars worth of jewelry, artifacts, and just plain money. It was worth more than all his ancestors had earned from Adam and Eve until now. She smiled at her thought. It was much better that servants, even loyal ones, not suspect these little moments of vulnerability. She was sure he would have killed her for much less than he was carrying now. She got into her car, watched him put her suitcase in the trunk, and close it. She said to her driver, "The airport." He drove expertly, maneuvering the black Maybach 62S through the streets of Guatemala City. He never betrayed any stress and seldom even applied the brakes. The ride was smooth and quiet, the way he knew she liked it. As she watched the city slipping past the windows of the car, she felt a small twinge of heartache. She had succeeded in obtaining the Mayan Codex, almost certainly the last undiscovered one in existence. By now, she should have been famous. She should have had a warehouse full of gold and priceless pottery. She would have to persuade Diego San Martin that she had not been the cause of his lost manpower. She would explain that the problem had begun with the man he had met at lunch. Russell had assured her that it would all be easy and safe. There would be no risk of disappointing Diego San Martin, because Russell had everything under control. What could she, a young woman, have done differently? How could she have known Russell was so wrong? She listened to her own silent rehearsal and pronounced herself satisfied. San Martin was like everyone else. He would vent his wrath on someone, but it would not be Sarah Allersby. She remained a very useful ally that would cost him money and be trouble to lose. San Martin just needed an excuse to do what was obviously in his own interest. The Maybach arrived at the airport and floated past the terminals along the chain-link fences to the special entrance to the private jet hangars. The guard opened the gate as soon as her car was in sight. Some crazy revolutionary wasn't going to drive up in a car worth nearly $500,000 and blow up a plane. Her driver took her to her hangar, and she saw the plane had already been towed out. The pilot, Phil Jameson, was going through his pre-flight check. The fuel truck was driving off down the line toward its next customer. Sarah Allersby's steward, Morgan, was visible through the lighted windows, refilling the refrigerator and stocking the bar. The Maybach stopped, and she said to the driver, "I'll be away for at least a month. You'll get 30 days' pay, and then you'll be called when I need you again." "Yes, ma'am." He popped the trunk, took out her suitcase, and rolled it to the plane. Morgan came to take it for her. He carried it up the steps, placed it in the closet, closed the door, then placed a strap across the opening so even if the door opened, it couldn't move. "Can I take your coat?" "Yes," she said, and shrugged it off. It took only a few more minutes before the cabin door was closed and the pilot began to taxi out toward the end of the runway. A few minutes more and the plane turned into the wind, sped along the runway, and lifted into the air. As Sarah looked out the window and down, she saw the little country receding below her, keeping with it all the recent strife and disappointment, and the unpleasant little people who had thwarted her efforts. As her plane rose above the puffy layer of white clouds into the dark sky, she felt lighter, cleaner, and without unpleasant encumbrances. She was flying home,
to London. It would be comforting to visit her father and to shelter in his big, powerful presence. And London was still London. Maybe this trip would be fun.
Frijanes, Guatemala. The truck carrying Russell and Ruiz reached the large, forbidding Pavón prison at the edge of the suburban town of Frijanes. As they joined the men being herded out of the army trucks, Ruiz said, "I don't see any lawyers." Russell said, "They'll be here. She wouldn't let us rot in a place like this." The soldiers herded them in through a high gate made of iron bars with razor wire at the top. Ruiz whispered, "I don't even see any civilian guards. I think this is one of those places where the prisoners run things." "Don't worry," said Russell. "She'd have to be crazy to abandon us."
"Let's hope she's not," said Ruiz. "Either way, we'd better get ready to make our own way out."
London. It was morning when Sarah Allersby's plane descended over London and then reached Biggin Hill Airport southeast of the city. The plane landed smoothly on the suburban airport's main runway and taxied to the flight line, where its only passenger would disembark. The plane stopped, and the ground crew chocked its wheels and attached the grounding wire to the electrical ground. Then the steps were lowered. Sarah could breathe in the cool, damp British air that came in through the open hatch. She stood up just as the British customs men arrived. They collected the customs declaration that Morgan the steward had filled out and initialed for her. She had brought, as always, 50 Cuban cigars for her father that had been miraculously marked down to less than £300. The fully stocked bar in the plane was said to be less than 2 liters.
The head customs man said, "Is that your suitcase, miss?"
"Yes, it is," said Sarah Allersby.
"May I look inside?"
She hesitated, her eyes suddenly unblinking and her lips parted. Usually the customs people didn't bother looking so closely. She was a person of importance from an ancient family. She wasn't going to be bringing in explosives or a bag of cocaine. She wasted a tenth of a second wanting to say, "You never asked before," and she sensed that her instant of hesitation might be enough to doom her. The head customs man opened her suitcase on the built-in table. He flipped the jewel box open, apparently just confirming that she'd be carrying more jewels than a Spanish treasure ship. He saw the banded stacks of money and set them aside. Of course she'd have money, no matter. "But what's this?" The customs man popped the plastic cover and examined the folded strip of ancient fig bark, caught sight of the paintings inside, and closed it.
"Miss Allersby, this appears to be a genuine Mayan artifact. A codex."
She looked at the man closely and saw that he was an educated man.
She was not going to talk him out of his appraisal of the codex by saying it was a copy or a decoration or something.
He was right, and he knew it. 3 hours later, a gang of her father's solicitors and barristers, men famous for keeping every kind of inconvenient question unanswered, had rescued her. She was not going to be allowed to leave the country. Her passport was being held for ransom. But most irritating of all was the fact that the codex, her precious Mayan codex, had been confiscated as evidence that she had broken the international law against transporting historical treasures. It was the most important of the lawyers, Anthony Brent Greaves, who sat beside her in his limousine to spirit her away from the authorities. While they were driving into the city, she said, "Anthony, I'm too exhausted to jump right into setting up a household. Take me to my father's house in Knightsbridge."
"I'm sorry," said Greaves. "He asked me to tell you it wouldn't be possible right now. He's got a dinner party, and there will be several people there who attract the press."
"Oh," she said. "So he won't see me?"
"I wouldn't put it that way," Greaves said. "You may be the one in the family who knows the habits and taboos of faraway places.
but he's the old hand in the jungles of London. He's going to work the powerful in your interest, but quietly.
I understand. Greaves had won his point. He spoke to his driver.
We'll take Lady Sarah to her house in Brompton.
Chapter 34. Santa Maria de los Montañas. The Guatemalan army arrived in the town of Santa Maria de los Montañas on a Monday. On Tuesday, a helicopter landed in a cornfield a mile from the town. Out of it stepped Commander Rueda. When Rueda and his lieutenants arrived in the town square, Sam and Remy were among the people waiting to greet him. Sam said, "It's good to see you again, Commander. What brings you here?" Rueda shrugged, but he couldn't hide a smile.
"It seems that Sarah Allersby has been arrested in London for bringing a Mayan codex into the United Kingdom. So some powerful people have had to change their positions on these matters quickly. I've been appointed acting commander of the government forces in the region."
"Congratulations," said Remy. "Is it proper to ask what you're going to do?"
"Certainly. I want to be very open about everything we do. Right now, I have troops in the Estancia Guerrero searching for drugs. There are others in Guatemala City searching Sarah Allersby's home, office, and a few business properties for signs that she's been plundering archaeological sites."
"Hooray for you," said Remy.
"I hope you'll still feel that way if we ask you to testify," said Rueda.
"We'll be delighted," said Sam. "It will give us an excuse to come back here. We've made some good friends." He noticed some faces nearby.
"Here are two of them that you should know, Father Gomez and Dr. Huerta. This is Commander Rueda, my friends. He is honest, completely aware of the problems in the area, and fortunately for everyone, the officer in charge from now on."
Rueda gave a slight military bow.
"I've heard of you both. We know you've been trying to stop the movement of drugs, and if I may say so, the people of Guatemala thank you for your courage."
Remy was distracted. She pointed down the long road. Far away, a low black cloud had stretched across the horizon.
"Look," she said, "a fire."
Rueda gave it a glance.
"My men are conducting a controlled burn of the marijuana fields at Estancia Guerrero. I understand they've confirmed your identification of coca trees, too. Everything beyond what they've kept for evidence is being destroyed."
He looked at his two aides.
"I guess we'd better be going. There's much to do."
Sam and Remy drove Rueda and his aides to the helicopter. Just as Rueda was about to board, he took Sam and Remy aside.
"This probably isn't going to mean anything, but I have to tell you that the two men who tried to kill you a few weeks ago were among the men captured. After 2 days in a prison near the capital, they killed two men who were about to leave on a work release assignment and took their places. We think they've left the country, but we're not sure."
"We'll keep our eyes open," said Sam. As the rotors began to turn, he and Remy stepped back to avoid the wash of air and watched them depart. Sam reached for his cell phone and called Selma.
"Sam and Remy, I was worried about you," she said. "Did you get everything resolved?"
"I did," said Sam. "Has David Kane arrived yet?"
"David Kane? Is he coming?"
Selma said, "He was always planning to come. Final examinations ended on Friday. It's June, Sam. You're studying the Mayans, and nobody has a calendar."
"Oh," he said. "I guess we should have remembered."
David Kane arrived at the head of a convoy of Land Rovers, which made their way up the hill with relative ease, and then pulled up in a row on the street just beyond the church. Kane jumped down and threw his arms around Sam and Remy.
"I've heard what you two did. You're amazing."
"Thanks," said Remy quietly. "What you and your colleagues will find here is more amazing. But you'd better let us smooth the way before you do any exploring. In the meantime, smile at everybody, talk to them about anything except archaeology, and be patient. We've already cleared the way for a public meeting where we can introduce you.
Chapter 35. London. Sarah Allersby was bored in London. In Guatemala City, she had been the center of attention. In parts of Europe, she had been invited to everything. Rome, Athens, Berlin, Prague. Even in Paris, she had been to the best places with sought-after young people. But now, because of the ridiculous court order, she was not permitted to leave rainy, cold, damp London. Worse, the social climate in London had not been warm. She'd had such bad press for the past couple of months, with the accusations that she'd looted Mayan tombs, claimed to discover sites that had already been registered, and used a Mayan codex she wasn't supposed to have. Beginning a day ago, rumors about her had begun to circulate, and she was being associated with some huge drug bust in Central America. People had already canceled their RSVPs, so the welcome home dinner party she was throwing for herself was dissolving. She could hear the fear in their voices. They had been scared their precious reputations would be tarnished if they shared hors d'oeuvres with mad, bad Sarah Allersby. A year ago, any of them would have come to her party, even if they'd had to crawl to her house on their knees. She stood in front of the big mirror by the door and inspected herself as she buttoned her navy blue coat. The buttons were gold, and the coat looked like a piece of an 18th-century naval officer's uniform. She half turned to present her profile to the mirror, stepped to the door, and opened it. The .308-caliber bullet pierced her forehead and passed through the back of her skull, destroying her brain so fast that she never heard the report of the rifle, if there was one. Through the rifle scope, Russell could see that she had fallen backward, and the heavy front door had begun to swing closed. It had been stopped by one of her feet, so it looked as though it had been partially opened by someone about to leave, who had gone back in to get something. Russell put down the rifle while Ruiz closed and locked the window and then drew the curtain. Russell quickly dismantled the rifle and placed it in his suitcase. He and Ruiz hurried down the back staircase, then into the kitchen and out the back door to the garden. It was mid-morning, so there were cars and people on nearby streets, but nobody seemed to have noticed anything. The house they had been in was for sale. It was only one number down and across the street from Sarah's, and it was the same kind of place. £4 million was what they'd been asking. Russell and Ruiz had spent only about an hour in the house, and had worn rubber gloves. As Russell rushed through the back garden, such a British thing in itself, he felt satisfied. Sarah had broken her promise and let him and Ruiz go to a Guatemalan jail. So now she had received her payment. Russell got into the car that they'd left waiting at the curb, and Ruiz drove. Ruiz seemed to be better at driving on the wrong side of the road. He stopped the car on the way so Russell could drop the pieces of the rifle in a series of trash cans. At Waterloo Station, they stopped in a men's room to change clothes and wash their hands. They took the big yellow and white Eurostar train to Paris. It would take them 3 hours to get there, but they had premium first-class tickets, and the ride promised to be restful. And anything was better than the prison they'd escaped from in Guatemala. The train chugged slowly through London and its inner suburbs, and then gained speed. After about an hour, it entered the tunnel under the English Channel, and the windows went dark. Santiago Obregón looked from the passageway of the train at the two Americans in their premium seats. They appeared to be sleeping. It was astounding to Obregón that these two imagined that Diego San Martín would let them waste nearly 100 of his men and go off to Europe in safety. He was grateful to them for killing Sarah Allersby, because otherwise he'd have had to do it.
Obregón sat across from the Americans in their compartment as though he belonged there. He reached into his briefcase and took out his tool, a CZ-P07 duty pistol with a factory-threaded muzzle and special high sights to provide a view over the sound suppressor. He shot the two Americans in the chest quickly to preclude resistance. He stood and shot the first American in the head to be sure he'd died, and then aimed the gun at the head of the second.